Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
So I've probably shared in this space, and if I haven't, I will now. My maternal grandfather was Jewish, and in my mother's family's old farm in Massachusetts, he lived there for a time. He had a shofar, a ram's horn, and I don't think I ever heard it blown. And for a long time, I had no idea what it was because the High Holy Days were not a part of our more secularly, culturally Jewish mixed with Catholic Unitarian Universalist upbringing. But eventually I learned. So the ram's horn is blown on the new year, Rosh Hashanah. There's also feasting and prayers and readings. And the days of Rosh Hashanah usher in this 10-day period called the Days of Awe. And these are days in which people take stock of their lives and their behaviors, make apologies, make new commitments. We'll talk about it again next week when we're closer to Yom Kippur. We are in these days right now. And Marge Piercy, in that poem, The Birthday of the World, she writes that most years in these days, she would be thinking about what she had or hadn't done in her relationships, but that this year, she wants to hold herself to task on what she's done or not done for peace, how she's worked for the freedom of all people. In the poem, she writes that she's convicted herself of sloth. She is judging herself and wishing for the tools to turn her words into actions for the sake of the world. We have in Unitarian Universalism a deep and abiding commitment to social justice, right there alongside our deep and abiding commitment to a sense of unity, and indeed those are entangled. They go hand in hand, and often I will lift up the unity as coming from the Unitarians and the justice from our Universalist forebears, but Unitarianism has both, and Universalism has both. Unitarianism, as we talked about last week, can trace a thread far back down the line of Christian heresies. Universalists are a somewhat newer thing, though if we wanted to push, we could definitely find tidbits of people here and there who believed in universal salvation. But the story that we tell of our Universalist background really is a story that takes root in late 18th century. As with many inventions and advancements in human thought, there wasn't just one place that Universalism came up, but we usually talk about John Murray in New Jersey. So John Murray, for anyone who doesn't know, was a preacher in England, and after his wife and child died, he decided to start again, and he sailed to America. The ship was headed for New York, but a thick fog rolled in, and the ship ran aground in New Jersey. John was among the people who hopped off the boat to see what was going on, where they were, what was happening, and there was a farmhouse nearby. That farmhouse belonged to a man named Thomas Potter. Potter invited him for dinner, and he showed him a chapel he'd built years before, a chapel that was empty, but he'd built it in the hopes that one day a preacher would arrive. That's some faith. And what Potter wanted was a preacher to arrive who would preach the message of a loving God who would save all people. So he was looking for a Universalist preacher, and that's what Murray was. But Murray was like, no, I left that behind. I don't want to do it. So they struck a deal. And Potter said, if the winds don't shift and your boat is still here on Sunday, will you come back and preach? And the winds did not shift, and the boat did not move. And so John Murray came back that Sunday, September 30th, 1770, and he preached in that chapel, and he kept right on preaching in that chapel. And so Murray is often considered the father of Universalism. What made his message so appealing and so timely was that, in part, it was a breath of fresh air. The American religious landscape was rife not only with fire and brimstone, but a very particular type of fire and brimstone that said, you're being saved, you are not, and nothing you do is going to change it. It was a Calvinist notion of predestination. And this did not sit well with everyone, as you might imagine. In the mid-Atlantic, in Massachusetts, with Murray in New Jersey, there were people saying, no, why would a God create a world, create humanity, only to condemn part of it to eternal damnation? And they wouldn't. God wouldn't, they reasoned. God would, in God's eternal power, do the work of saving everyone at the end. Universal salvation, the universalists claimed, was the only thing that they could understand out of their reading of the scriptures. It was a quick trip from believing in a God who would save everyone to believing that every human being is equal. Already in those earliest days, universalist congregations were inclusive for their time, and in 1863, they actually were the first to ordain a woman into full denominational ordination. That woman was Olympia Brown. But one of my favorite universalist theologians comes a little bit later. His name was Clarence Russell Skinner, and he lived from 1881 to 1949. And he wrote this little book, it's a slim little volume, called The Social Implications of Universalism, which for me like perfectly describes where the universalists were coming from and what they were calling for, and it helps me at least to understand why we are the way we are. He wrote, "Universalism triumphantly holds to the universal salvation of all mankind. It believes that all human souls are children of God with a spark of the divine in their nature, and that eventually, after the varied experiences of this world and the next, those souls will reach a perfect harmony with God. Never was there such a bold proclamation of brotherhood as this. Never such implicit faith in the solidarity of the human race." So this is where they started. This was their foundation. If God, they understood, as a creator, and then every human being a reflection of God, a child of God, a sibling of every other human being. Parenthood of God equals siblinghood of people. That was the starting point. And no parent would condemn a child to eternal damnation, maybe punish them, but not for forever. And so everyone would be saved by this all-powerful creator in time. And from this belief that the universalists held developed a deep conviction that because of this familial relationship shared through God that would lead to all being saved, we have not only no business judging each other or demeaning each other or oppressing each other, but in fact, we are called to lift each other up into justice and equity. This is what Skinner inherited from earlier universalists who were already championing the other. But Skinner also explains how universalism began to shift from a very distinctly Christian positioning into a more open theological positioning. He writes, "The genius of universalism is liberty. Its fathers dared to challenge the olden tyrannies of ecclesiastical authority and interpret life in larger, more triumphant terms. They fought the battles of religious and civil freedom, and today one of the most splendid characteristics of the Universalist Church is the unchallenged right of every individual to interpret the fundamentals of religion according to his own conscience. Such intellectual liberalism and such broad fellowship have put Universalists in the forefront among defenders of the new science. They have been among pioneers who have helped to harmonize that science with religion. When it was heresy to believe in evolution, our fathers dared to proclaim it as doctrine which would save religion, not destroy it." So not unlike the heretics, the Unitarians that we talked about last week, the Universalists had to fight for their right to believe and interpret and determine for themselves meaning in this world. This left them with an intensely personal understanding of what it meant to be denied that freedom. And so they didn't seek to deny it to anyone else. And not only in religious terms. Universalism, by its very genius, he wrote, is led into the great social maelstrom because it is essentially a battle for the freedom of the common man. It is a struggle for complete emancipation. The only world that reflects true siblinghood and universal salvation is a world of true justice and equity. And that siblinghood was reflected in the deepening understandings of our common ancestry. Charles Darwin died the year after Skinner was born, but those concepts of evolution and natural selection, the mapping of species, the understanding of the amazing diversity of life, continued to shift through Skinner's life, and it has shifted even down into our own. More and more, we understand human beings, the universe we were born into, the creatures that live here with us. More and more, we understand and we come to see that the building blocks of life are all the same. We come to see that the lines between us and animals are, as Jane Goodall says, wuzzy. We come to see that all of us embody billions of years of evolution, of energy and matter being transformed and passed along, of cells that are the same all over the universe. Carl Sagan says that every cell is a triumph of natural selection, and we are made of trillions of cells. Within us is a little universe. We are each of us a multitude. In the most basic physical sense, we are connected not only to each other, but down through time and space. Person to person, we can recognize a common humanity, regardless of race or creed or color or gender or anything else. And we can see that commonality back through time in that unbroken thread that connects us to the very first life on Earth. We have a shared ancestry and a shared humanity that universalists intuited in their reading of the scriptures and in their beliefs about God, but that has been borne out in scientific inquiry. We know now how closely we are all related. When you take together the universalist drive for freedom, intellectual, religious, and in every other sense, and the universalist commitment to universal siblinghood as confirmed by science, we can totally understand how we are here, sitting side by side with people who maybe have very different theological viewpoints than we do. And you can see how that space opens for diverse theology and a stress on justice. It isn't enough to confirm our connections if we stand idly by and watch our siblings harmed and mistreated. It isn't enough to affirm that in the future they'll know peace and be compensated. There's a driving force in universalism that says that we have to create a heaven on earth now, reflecting the oneness and the holiness of all people. And so they fought for women's rights and civil rights and an end to slavery and for gay marriage. And so we work today for transgender rights and an end to racism and white supremacy, for an end to misogyny and xenophobia, not because we all believe in a God who created this world and of whom we are all children, but because we believe what science tells us, that we not only have a shared history and a common present that means we are made of the same stuff, but because logic and reason tell us that we also have a shared future. Skinner wrote, "Instinctively, we reject the old aristocratic ideas of God, which meant a divisive caste system for men, ruled over by an imperious partial power. Again, we instinctively turn from the old religion, which depicted men divided into the saved and the lost. We believe in the solidarity of humankind. We are all of one blood. Our fortunes and our destinies are so interlocked that we all move on together, whether we will or no." Skinner and others knew, and we now know, that a vision of true siblinghood forces us to realize that the oppression of one means we are all oppressed, that the lack of freedom for one means that we all lack true, complete freedom. Those are the justice-oriented principles that universalism hands to us. And this is the call that we are left with, to make this earth as close to heaven as possible, embodying the love that they believed was embodied in their God. We don't need to bring forward their God. You can if you want to, but you don't have to bring forward their commitment to humanity. It really is, as Skinner wrote, a bold proclamation. This proclamation of our shared humanity. Even now, in the 21st century, the message of universalism is saving. not because of the God or heaven they envisioned, but because of the radical welcome it demands of its adherents and that it offers to all. So many places in this world, so many communities and religions and families and people draw lines. If you're black, if you're gay, if you're transgender, if you're poor, if you're a woman, if you're uneducated, if you struggle with illness, if you belong to a different ethnic group, we could go on. For those of us who have ever found ourselves cut out of a circle because of who we are, the saving message that all of us are worthy, that all of us are connected, that all of us are welcome, and all of us are loved, that is a real saving message. It's a life-changing message. And we don't always talk this way because our rationalist Unitarian roots are deep, but it can be life-changing. I've seen it happen. And that's the heart of universalism that can save everyone. When we fully stand by the call to treat everyone as a sibling, to welcome all, to embrace all, we can change the world one life at a time. We can save lives by affirming the truth of our shared humanity. May we never forget the power inherent in the bold proclamation of universalism. May we live always into the truth of our common ancestry and our common future. And may we spread ever outward a message of welcome and love. So may it be.